I never know if they're worth taping, so you tape them and then you throw them away after, but sometimes you keep them. And I'm accumulating them and accumulating until I feel I have confidence enough that I've accumulated enough words that I can get somebody to say, you can go online and get Heather's talks. But I'm not quite at that point yet, but they're coming. Albert Einstein, our friend Albert Einstein. Any intelligent fool can make things bigger, more complex, and more violent. It takes a touch of genius, and he would know, and a lot of courage to move in the opposite direction. And any intelligent fool can make things bigger, more complex, and more violent. It takes a touch of genius and a lot of courage to move in the opposite direction. Smaller, more simple, and more loving, in other words, we are becoming. So I want to talk about all the same things, the same thing we've been talking about. We all talk about the same thing. How we keep saying it is remarkable. How we keep filling up hour after hour with saying the same thing year after year is extraordinary. Anyway, I'll give it another shot. The actual part that I want to get to tonight, hopefully this is the main point of what I want to talk about, is the happiness of it all. The happiness that comes from doing all this. Another quote I'll read. I was going to read this at the end, but I'll read it at the beginning, in spite of this, really. We do not receive wisdom. We must discover it for ourselves. After a journey through the wilderness, which no one else can make for us, which no one can spare us, for our wisdom is the point of view from which we come at last to regard the world. So, we're not trying to spare you your journey, but where we come to, as we continue on, is an increasing sense of happiness and well-being. And so, this is what I want to laud tonight. L-A-U-D. So I'll talk first of all a little about the happiness that comes from our actual practicing, the sitting here practicing, and how increasingly this produces its own sense of inner well-being and happiness. As I began to say, as I began to say some other night, one aspect of meditation is the joy and rapture. When I was talking about the seven factors of awakening, an aspect of practice as the mind settles down and all, the joy and the rapture and so on, which come from the mind that gets concentrated. The factors of a concentrated mind, the first ones are, early ones are piti, joy, happiness, delight. Rapture is that tricky word, and I've already described to some degree what I mean by this, but there are these states that arise spontaneously as the mind settles down. It's not about the states themselves, which delicious as they may be, and sort of soothing or compelling and fascinating as they may be, weird as they sometimes are. The value of them is that the kind of happiness and delight that suffuses the system when one has periods of such settledness reveal to the system that the otherwise, what we thought of as happy states and things that we want and the chasing in the material world, is very trivialized in comparison. And so it really does refocus our attention and our intentions. It sends us off in this other direction, an inner direction. That's the value of it, the insights that come. When one's really, really, really peaceful, peace is seen as way much more desirable than being thrilled or ecstatic, for instance, which is pretty exhausting in comparison, and so on. There's a sense of contentment that comes with such inner quiet delight And so one feels very filled up, very, very satisfied, so well nourished. The experience, one of the experiences that I can say is in a state of deep absorption, it feels, I remember feeling this clearly, like each cell was going, like it was having a long drink and it had never had one. It had been in the desert forever. Sort of on a cellular level, it felt like that. But what happens when one is being nourished is the outcome is one then is satisfied. And that's a very peaceful place to be, to not be wanting or needing anything further. Another aspect that comes from meditation itself is the fascination and the delight of being with ourselves and our stuff and figuring out our stuff and learning about me and how I work and how I do this. And some of it's embarrassing and some of it's downright, you know, regretful, but a lot of it is very intriguing. We're most interested in our little selves, and we get to be with it, and we get to see a whole lot of how it works, and it's fabulous, and very interesting, and very helpful, because we do get to understand why we are the way we are, and how we are, and the story, and how it unfolded. And so it's therapeutic, and helpful, and purifying, all these things. It's pleasurable. That's not the point of practice. The point of practice is to do your own therapy and get to understand your personality level, even though we do, and it works, and it is really very freeing and so on and so forth, expansive. It's way more profound. The teachings of the Buddha take us to way, way deeper levels of well-being than those. But those aren't to be discounted. You know, those are very necessary. Then we have a greater, more profound, more impersonal delight through various insights that we get. You know, as we have something dawns on us and we realize some big truth, it's accompanied by such a sense of rightness and such a sense of, like, it's different for everybody, but there's always this kind of, yes, oh my God. I know this stuff, but wow. It's sort of amazement. And stimulus from this bigger, beyond world, the deeper, meaningful world. It's rich for us. It's delicious. It's really why, really what we're looking for in the material world and when we come to, you know, practice. It isn't to, you know, get to know ourselves and like ourselves. It is too, but in a deeper way, get to actually know and understand the big truth. So it begins to be really an expansive reality. So whatever kind of insight, which we have as an example of our own personal situation or story, the profundity of meaning of all of this, you know, the way it connects us with how things are really working in this big world of being humans and in nature and so on, is it's inspiring and it's exciting. Uplifting, all those words, and reflect on that. And when you do have whatever insights you have, you know, and you realize, for example, you know, when my heart feels so tender, it is such a beautiful, warm, lovely feeling, and it's such a vulnerable, fragile feeling, and I'm so sensitive to the pain as well. Yes, that's right. When hearts open, they feel it all, the joys and the sorrows. It's true, isn't it? And we know that in theory, but to experience it, it's like, yes, actually, yeah. That's why I haven't let myself open. It's not because I don't want to be loving. It's that I'm afraid of the vulnerability that goes with it. But the nourishment that, and the rightness that we get when we know that deep truth, it's like, yes, we're aligning with bigger wisdom, and it feels so good. The biggest aspect of insights that we get during the journey of discovery as we go on, however it manifests, whatever, you know, particular scenario is manifesting in, we see more and more that at the heart of all this is a process unfolding. At the heart of all this, we glimpse in different ways. We get these glimpses that there actually isn't the me that I believed I was in here. We get those moments of realization, those moments of glimpsing the non-self or the unconditioned or the non-dual or whatever the words you may find are your words in it, which are absolutely shattering. They're absolutely fantastically amazing. And yet at the same time, like, of course. Absolutely. We know it's true and right, but there's something so wonderful about the insights into the not really self that we thought we were, the not taking ourselves seriously. This is why we're doing this. This is the liberation, from the small, tight confines of who I thought I was and what I thought I needed to have and get and do. When I come to sit, especially if I'm going to teach, to speak, to say something, when I gather myself in front of the Buddha, I'm reorienting myself to any such state that I've experienced to try and help me speak to you from as little about me as possible. That's what I actually do in acknowledging the Buddha. I acknowledge Buddhahood, you know, in whatever way I can even remember or re-tune into that feeling. Another thing that's a delight about practice that comes with time, and these things aren't necessarily, none of it is solid, it comes and goes, but increasingly comes, is this sort of amazement and delight at how the practice does it, how it just gets going. And we, as I was saying the other night, we do less and less, and we settle back and relax, and awareness is just showing things. The same way when we did that exercise with Mark, and he said, okay, now then, don't notice anything. And you really get to see that you actually don't have to do so much. There is doing at times and from time to time, but increasingly there is awareness happening, awareness revealing what's to be seen, and we aren't there doing it. And that is a lovely, lovely feeling. It's a relief feeling. We get confident. You know, it's like, this is amazing. It's inspiring and all that. So these are some of the delights of practice. The clarity that we see things, the depth that we see things, the subtlety with which we see things. It's just, isn't it amazing? I know, I notice, I've never seen it so clearly. There's a beauty to that. So we do, believe it or not, those who are new to this practice, it gets to be fun. You get to want to do it. You don't do it because, oh, I know, somewhere, if I go and do another retreat, I will find something that feels better, I'm sure, so I'm going to go. You actually want to. You want more, it's an addiction. I always warn people, you know, I teach introductory classes, beware. You know, this is going to get to you, you're going to want more of it. Yeah, so just that, to say that, this extraordinary wonder of glimpsing as it comes in glimpses what's possible for humans, what's possible for this human, the deep depths of amazing truths, the profundity of it, the expansiveness of it. It's beautiful, it's awesome. And these moments are the jewels, they're called the jewels of practice, the fruits of practice. There's a Sayadaw, Burmese Sayadaw called Ledi Sayadaw, the late 1800s. He wrote this, if the pleasure and joy experienced in Vipassana happiness, which is complete with the seven factors of awakening, as I was mentioning the other night, were to be divided into 256 parts. Don't ask me why he said that part. Something about 16 times 16. Some mathematician came up and told me after a Dharma talk when I said this quote, and I also said I can't think why he came up with that number, the square root of 16. If it were divided into 256, the joy of happiness, of the Vipassana happiness, one single part of that, like a 256th of the Vipassana happiness, that joy and pleasure exceeds the worldly joys and pleasures of kings among humans and devas among Brahmins. So great is the joy and pleasure inherent in these factors of awakening. without interrupting, I'll read his quote right from the beginning to the end. If the pleasure and joy experienced in Vipassana happiness, which is complete with the seven factors of awakening, were to be divided into 256 parts, one single part of that joy and pleasure exceeds the worldly joys and pleasures of kings among humans and devas among brahmas. So great is the joy and pleasure inherent in these factors of awakening. That's something. That's pretty nice. And the amazing thing is, it's yours. It isn't somebody else's. And you're going to maybe win the lottery someday. It's actually definitely so. It's here, you have it. It's just covered up. Okay, so those are some of the aspects of practicing itself. But I want to more talk about the effects of this stuff on our lives and how it works in our lives and the part of sitting here. Great as that is. First of all, to mention, as we know, just to remind you, in case you were forgetting, that mostly we seek worldly happiness. Lokottara sukha. Sukha is sweetness. In things like sense pleasure, delicious food, comfortable accommodations, the textures, pleasant textures. I'm a sensuous type of person. And when I was 18 at a college in London, September through until May, therefore through the winter, it was in 1966 or 7 or something like that, from the classroom, there was a small college, I don't know what, 60 or 70 students, the small classroom, the hallway to a cafeteria, and I had one particular friend, Angela, and as I was walking down the hallway, she was behind me one time, and we went to the cafeteria, and she sat beside me, and she said, "Do you know that you touched every fur coat in the hallway?" Those are the kind of things that we find delight in. I mean, there's more than just plain delight. There's value in it. You know, the studies of people recover from illness and surgeries and stuff more rapidly if they have a cat to pet. And, you know, I mean, it's good for the nervous system. I like to reassure myself. But then the various other things, not just the sense on the sense level, the things that feel good, but the things that make our sense of ourselves feel good, you know, are things that stroke our egos, where we get accolades and fame and success and wealth and, you know, the looking good stuff and all of that. We seek all of that, happiness in those things, as we know, in certain kind of relationships we look for, and achievements, as we all know, and many others. The thing about these, which we also know, but it's good to be reminded, is that each one of these kinds of happiness depend on something happening for us to have it. I've got to have the fur coat to enjoy stroking it. You know, got to have that food in order to enjoy eating. You've got to have that exchange with somebody to find that feeling. You have to receive that love note in order to feel that, and so on and so forth. It's very fragile, very unreliable, and will pass rapidly. Completely dependent on the conditions which produced it. And as all things change, those conditions change. So our happiness is utterly unstable. And we don't know any other way. The uninstructed worldling, as the Buddha called us, we know no other way, so we just keep on frantically chasing more fur coats, etc. Provisional, I like that word. Provisional, conditional. So the happiness that comes from having an inner life develop is what I'm really wanting to talk about. Usually, untrained, undisciplined, a way of seeing the mind is that it's fractured, it's scattered, it's partly here, partly here, partly there, multitasking and jumpy and nervy, as I said the other night. So when we're doing anything in any sort of situation, we're partly there, or we're partly doing something else at the same time, or many things. So we're driving down the road, part of us is driving down the road, part of us is planning the conversation that we're going to have when we get to the person we're going to meet, and part of us is remembering that we must do something when we get back home again, etc. Or we're having a conversation with somebody we've met on the street, and we're half listening to what they're telling us, and we're sort of interested in what they're saying, and we need to pee, and we, you know, the time's getting on, and we have to do something else, and we're meeting someone else, and we're saying, oh yes, that's very interesting, but we're not really there, really. And that's how we go through all of it. We think we're clever because we can do 10 things at once. But we forget half of what those things are because we weren't really there for it. And the people that we meet in that way, which is most people, aren't really met by us the way, you know, we aren't really met by them. When we meet somebody who's, you know, like, oh, hi, how are you? Yeah, you know, they ask you the sort of superficial question and they don't really want to stick around for the answer and they're still getting something off the shelf in a supermarket. How do you feel? Totally adored? Nope. Somewhat dismissed. I have a friend who calls me on the fact that it seemed for quite a few times, whenever we were talking on the phone, I was also eating, and she didn't like that. That kind of feeling, fractured, not all really there. Or else there, but with our own agenda there. You know, we may be really interested in what someone's saying because we're turning it into something that we can then do something with, and that kind of thing. So not just 100% openly there. What happens with meditation practice, it's sort of like the power of it is the unifying. Like, for instance, laser beams. Laser beams are amazing. Or even when you're a child and you hold up your magnifying glass and you concentrate the sun's rays onto a dot and you watch the paper catch. It's just from the narrowing, the collecting of the force, we have so much energy. But because it's so fractured and scattered and all over the place and jumpy, it's not actually, we're not that powerful. We're pretty weakened, really. But by practicing training the mind and settling down, we develop this capacity to give ourselves completely to something if we choose to do it. And when we do that, and we're really there for something, it's way more rich for us. We totally understand and notice and appreciate what we miss. We see nuance and depth. When it's a person, we really connect with the person. The person feels really seen and met and held and cared for by our available consciousness. It's way more wholesome, instead of fractured. It's the opposite. The Buddha used this word that means wholesome. Wholesome is the same root as heal, healing, healthy. It's unified. Together. This, when we apply this steadiness, it's extraordinary. Extraordinary because it's not the way we normally are. And the effects are interesting. We find that we're not so stressed out. We find that we don't feel so compelled by external forces. Oh, I have to do this, and oh, I'm just getting so upset by that. Because the unified mind is able to make some choices here. Do I actually have to get this done and rush out tonight? I said I would, and I thought I'd like to, and now it's turning into a monster that's driving me crazy. Do I actually need to? And the calm mind can say, you're getting all frazzled here. This isn't necessary. It probably won't be worth it. And you can make some choice. For example, before you just like, you fill your diary up and then that's it. You've got to like rush from one thing to the next and feel completely out of control without even realizing. Or you react, as we know. We react to some situation with whatever it may be, the spontaneous response, and we aren't steady. We don't even know that's what's happening. Imbalance, as I was saying the other night. As a direct opposite to the kind of worldly happiness that I previously just described, which is completely dependent on changing conditions and therefore completely reliable, an inner sense of well-being that comes from steadiness and being more together, unified, being more confident, realizing I can decide to do this or not do this, whatever feels better. I'm becoming my own best friend. Not just a wish, I actually am becoming on my own side. I'm not sabotaging myself by being mad at myself as soon as I've done something I shouldn't do and then I can't stand myself. I'm actually witnessing myself and understanding myself and feeling kinder. This kind of happiness that comes from this sense of befriending oneself or understanding oneself or making appropriate, wholesome choices is not dependent on anything. And therefore, it's utterly reliable. It's completely dependable. It's unshakable. It's a capacity. It's an ability. It's sort of like a skill that grows, and there it is. Like riding a bicycle. You don't have to keep going through over and over, falling off, and trying to remember in your head. It's in you. You've gained that. The same way, this mind, this unified sensitive mind becomes your skill, your tool. This heart that is steady and unafraid and able to open to and be with difficult and beautiful and changing circumstances without getting upset when the pleasant leaves and so on is your reliable friend. It's your reliable place of refuge. We use words like abiding or peace. Like peace is an inner thing. It's not external. It's whatever happens, there's an inner place you can rest. It's an amazing thing. One of the reasons why we all love nature, because nature is so always nature. It's so reliably changing and so reliably extraordinary. In spring, however weird the weather does come, and seeds do sprout, and things grow upwards towards light. They just do. The laws, we use the word laws because they're so reliable. Like it unfolds absolutely this way, and we get a lot of steadiness and reassurance from that, and this law is also so. As the mind calms down and sees more clearly, the heart softens and opens, there is an unshakable deliverance of the heart. There is the ease and well-being that's available to you. The Buddha used the words in some of his writings of rest and relief. We think happiness. In fact, I don't actually like the word happy. It's very easy to associate with tra-la-la-la-la-la, superficial, jumping up and down and pigtails and Pollyannas and things. Not a very reliable state. But the state of well-being that I'm trying to refer to here is way more subtle and way more quiet. And the Buddha used these two, rest and relief. In fact, in one of his earliest teachings in the Sutta Nipata, the early sutta, he said, he admonished, advised, don't look for rest and relief in things which come and go. And we know that conditional world comes and goes, the worldly world is not where to look for it. But the point that's interesting is that he is assuming and knowing that what we all want actually isn't so much happiness, is rest and relief. And so whenever we do what we do because we like it, like go on holiday, or eat well, it isn't really about the eating the lovely stuff, which is very nice, the sensuous part. It's to have the feeling of rest and relief from being nourished, the peace that comes from that, the deeper well-being is one of rest and relief rather than what I would use the word happiness. And there's an ease in it. It's soft. We do think, because of the way our minds work, as we know how we do this, and our culture just exaggerates this to the max, is we tend to go towards the loud, the squeaky wheel, the dramas, the wonderful things and the awful things and the remarkable things. One of the things I remember early in my midwifery career grappling a little with was this phrase, unremarkable. Midwives' role is to deal with the women having babies where there's nothing particularly dramatically unusual going on. I mean, it's all dramatic to have a baby, but it's medically called unremarkable. It's a medical term. Unremarkable, I think. Unremarkable, meaning it isn't, we don't have to do medical anything. It just is how it is. And we mostly are preoccupied with the remarkable. And even if there isn't a remarkable, we turn something into remarkable so that we can be preoccupied with it. Like newspapers, you know, they're just trying to make any kind of remarkable anything out of anything. And the worse it is, then the more remarkable and the more the front page it's worthy of, you know. So we have this exaggerated sense of drama and color and melodrama and excitement and stimulus and, you know, we're all mesmerized by this. There's a car pulled over on the side of the road, you know, maybe we'll see something weird or gory or something dramatic or a fight, you know, or something, you know, anything, you know, there's a gathering of people and how desperately we're hungry for stimulus, we think. But that's all sort of made up. What we underneath really want is R&R. And because we look for the drama and we're so tuned into the excitement and the loud, the garish and the crude, we miss an awful lot. As Mark was talking about last night, we miss so much that isn't eye-catching in that way. And there are so many minutes. I mean, several of you today in conversation were talking about how much you actually hadn't appreciated your well-being, because we were sort of blinded by the struggle and had forgotten that in between there are all these other moments, which actually are unremarkable moments, moments of peace, moments of simplicity. And because the way we are in this way, stimulated by the drama, we tend to, when we think about things, which is our normal state, is sitting there thinking about rather than being with, which we're having to learn somewhat laboriously sometimes, we think about freedom and nirvana and the happiness that comes from liberation as being some great thing, some great, grand, bright, exciting, dramatic, wow, flashing lights, you know, choirs of angels drama. And it isn't. It's missable because it's not more of anything. It's less of everything. It's less action, it's less color, it's less sound, it's less feeling, it's less everything. It's more an absence than a presence. Why we don't have any words, for we have words like empty and spacious. What's that like? Because it's take away all the words that describe the being that our normal experiences of wondering and thinking and hoping and liking and loving and all of it, take it all away, and what's left is freedom from all of it that's now gone. Doesn't belong in our language, it's defining things. And our experiences chained to those things. And the freedom that comes here is this freedom that's less than all of these things. And it's sort of ordinary. It's peaceful. It's unremarkable. So it's unstimulating in that way. So therefore, it isn't a thing. It isn't a thing to get or a thing to have or to hang on to. It's just when the self is quiet, when the struggling needs of the ego and all of its chattering and trying to figure out and thinking and judging and all of it subside, all of that struggle is absent. Peace is there, quiet, unremarkable. One of the things I No, I think I'll say that in just a minute. When there's this absence of self, it's the self who worries. It's the self who takes herself so damn seriously. When she's not there so much, it just feels more fun. One of the descriptions of the Dalai Lama that somebody said is he's like a three-year-old. Did anybody here go and see the Dalai Lama when those 60,000 people saw him in Seattle? You went to go, Kathleen. You've seen him at different times. I'm sure some of us have seen him at different times. An example, a very good example of playfulness, spontaneous playfulness, ready laughter, a drop of a hat. You know, any little silly thing, it's just fine, thoroughly funny. I heard this, I didn't see this, but at one point he was in New York and Madison Square Gardens, and they'd set up a whole, it had to be a big high, I think, and it was out in the public somewhere, they had to set up a big high, many-stepped seat for so many people for him to get, and so he finally kind of climbs up this great thing, and thousands of people, and he sits down, and it's slightly bouncy. And so he sits down again, and he bounces a few times before he does his talk. You know, one of the greatest people in the world bouncing right in the middle of thousands of people. It's like, that's fun. Such a fabulous teaching. This is one of the joys that happens over time with meditation. It's we just like ourselves more, it's not that we love ourselves and we're great. It's not like that. It's not like we honor ourselves and it's all very profound. It's that it doesn't matter so much. So we can just be more lighthearted. We're more humorous about ourselves. Thank God for humor. Some of you have heard this, but I'll remind you of this one. I love this particular thing. Because we do tend to, we can get all precious about our stuff and ourselves and our needs and our practice and our being Buddhists and our being, you know, becoming wiser beings and nicer people. And we can get a little attached and pious about the whole thing. And so anti-piety is this little spoof, English style, Monty Python style, some of you know. So in this scene, it's the movie The Life of Brian. Anybody know this movie? Life of Brian. David knows already what I'm going to say. So it's the first scene of The Life of Brian, and it's The Life of Brian is actually Brian is instead of Jesus. And so it's mostly about not the life of, but the death of Jesus. So it's a total English complete spoof. And so the very first scene is a crowd scene with many layers of different things going on all at once. How they get to do this, I don't know how they do it, but there's one tiny little vignette going on in the midst of a lot of other things happening, and it's a little promenade of monks. And there's about 12 of them, and they're wearing black sort of monk's habits, but they've got big hoods, cowls, you know, rather like Ku Klux Klan, but black, so it's all very somber. And they're all walking along two by two, you know, six couples, whatever it is. And it's a small piece. You have to see the new movie a couple of times to notice this particular piece of it. And you hear when you've tuned it, they're all going, sort of dirge, you know, walking along. And then every so often, every number of seconds, simultaneously, turns out that they're all carrying boards down in front of them, like long, thin boards like this. Now we have to move the mic. And they all go simultaneously, and then they all walk on. So we have to be careful about our practice. Not too holy about it. Yeah, I was reflecting this morning while sitting here about saying this, yet another way to describe this practice, and just a little way that I saw in my mind that I wanted to describe a three-step piece. Step one, where we normally are untrained, is the one mind of the ego. Just the me and my drama world. I'm in my washing machine, or I'm in my TV, and I'm in my stuff. That's the step one of this journey. Step two, just a different way of describing it. Step two is there's the two minds. There's awareness, knowing the drama. There's anger happening, there's boredom happening, there's walking, being known. So there's awareness of the object of self. So self becomes the object of one's bigger self, awareness. That's like step two. Step three is, and how I see it in my mind is a dot is step one, a point. Like step two is a circle around the point. Awareness around the small, the big self around the small self, as it were, embracing the small little one and her little stuff. Step two. And step three is the little one disappears. The dot in the middle disappears and all there is awareness. And when all there is awareness, there is nothing separate from the awareness. There just is isness. And then one self and another one isn't any, there's no separation, it just is one thing. But in my mind, I saw like the small me and then my big wise self holding myself and helping myself see myself until my small self disappears. That sense of self disappears and all that's left is open, free, non-dual experience, which is love. Love isn't the thing that we think it is. Love isn't gushy and attached and exciting and all of those pink fuzzy things. I mean, we turned it into that, you know, red roses and chocolates and all those kinds of things. But what really is meant in this way, in a spiritual way, love, is non-separation. Is nothing in the way. Not me listening to you having a conversation on the street while I'm planning dinner and while I'm, you know, looking at the hairs in your nose, and it's just there's no difference, we're the one. That's what real love is. And so our practicing and where this takes us is, the whole point of this, is to see what's in the way of that. What are the pieces that I'm adding in the way between one experience and another? So we're not trying to develop to have two minds so that we can have two minds. Eventually there is no two again. But instead of it being the little one, there's the all. But the way we get there is by being able to recognize awareness, seeing the small one. So we begin with the one and its stuff and its stories and its dramas, and we look at it. And then we develop over time, and you'll notice as we gave the instructions over the duration of the retreat, notice more and more the big one, the big mind, the awareness. And as time, the little one falls away. And it does that. You can't do that. If you're trying to get rid of it, that little one is aware very much well. What our little egos do, and this is a good thing to remember, because in our experience this happens so much, is we make time big. We have this tendency where we think into the future and make it real. And we think into the past and we make it real, and we think, my whole life I have been blah, 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 blah. Or this is how it's going to be. I'm never going to be different from this. I have this personality, Aries, oh my goodness, it's always going to be here. We make it huge by stretching this moment into long term. That's a mental exercise which in true experience isn't real at all, it's fantasy. So we eternalize. And that's in time. We solidify time, but we solidify experience also. We make something really solid that is actually a moment of experience, because we think about it and we invest it with a story and with a meaning, you know, with expectation or not. We add all these flavors and meanings to things and make them way bigger than they are. And as we recognize that we do this, this is what ego does, it's how the mind perceives, as we see that, that happens less. As it happens less, things are not so big and they don't last so long. The eternalizing and solidifying lightens up. And so things are less solid. Whatever it is, your personality, the weather, the fact that it's windy, okay, so it's windy. So you know I've been saying several times that Utejaniya would say, so what? What he's saying is, It's not as solid as you think. It doesn't have as much meaning as you think. You're making this mean a lot more and getting all involved. It's just a moment of something. So what are you making it into? You're solidifying, or you're eternalizing, or both. Often it's about the same thing. That's what the Buddha means by craving, by clinging. Making something mean something and have to keep meaning it. Giving it, investing it in some kind of long-term big reality when it's a flicker. It's a flash. Fleeting. He who binds to himself a joy does the winged life destroy, says Blake. He who kisses a joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. Not to not love the joy, kiss it even. What a beautiful thing to do with joy. The most loving thing we can do is to kiss it as it goes by. Not grab it and hang on to it and need it and have to get it and spend your life scheming how to have it. It's a flash. It flies. Life flies. Life is fleeting. Let it be fleeting. We don't. We solidify and congeal around. So then I just want to think of a couple of aspects of love that are the pure love when there isn't a sense of separation. I actually just got an email, and I don't even remember who sent it to me, but it's one of these, you know, inspiring stories of a woman called Irina, and then a Polish name that I can't pronounce. And this isn't the first time I've heard this story, so I think it's one of these amazing stories that is sent around, you know, people who know that you like being inspired, and then they send it on, and a few months later somebody thinks you haven't got it and sends it to you again. Anyway, it's a story, and there's a photograph in the story of this woman who, at 92 years old, she just died recently, which is why it's come into the back into the circuit again, in Poland, and she has this 92-year-old face and twinkly, twinkly blue eyes and very apple-y cheeks and a mischievous little grin, beautiful-looking, sweetheart-looking woman. And she saved 2,500 Jewish babies from the ghetto in Warsaw in the beginning of the war. And she was a Catholic. And, you know, again and again. And she managed, she was working as a social welfare dispenser in some form or another and managed to get herself allocated to the ghetto, which soon enough the Jews were all hemmed in this ghetto, the 16 square block ghetto. 4,000 or thousands of people, and she would go in under the auspices of attending to the sick, and there were miscellaneous diseases going on at the time, so she could then go in and then bring out babies that she would often make to go to sleep with various herbs and stuff and say they died and bring them out and give them, and found homes for 2,500 babies. And she, all within a couple of years, and was then herself in prison because she was caught doing it. And then managed to, you know, get out because somebody bribed somebody. Anyway, she lived to a ripe old age. Almost all of them were. And what's amazing is that she wrote down the details of each child, family and name, and put the paper each time in a glass jar, which was buried in a neighbor's garden, so that she actually kept records. And many, many at the end of the war were actually, at least they knew about their families and any relative. And the agreement with any of the families who adopted these babies, or children and babies, not all babies, was that they were temporarily, they couldn't keep them, you know, they were to give them back if there was any way they could be taken back. So not like just taking them away from their roots and turning them into what they weren't, but actually supporting their culture and everything. Incredible. So she just died, this amazing woman. And, you know, there's comments of, she just said, well, you know, of course you do it. You know, like the note, you know, she'd been given various accolades and, you know, inducted into halls of fame, and she was just like, you know, like, well, of course you do what you can do. I happen to be in a position where they were these children. And she would have to convince the parents to give them up because she said, if you keep them, they for sure will die. And if I take them, they will survive. You know. Unbelievable. And this reminds me of another story that's a similar The point I'm making is of course you do this when there's no separation, and as Mark was saying, when there's a wound on the leg, the hand touches the, when it's hurt, when you bang your thumb with a hammer, you hold it, because it's like it's your hand and you feel the pain and it's all one thing. That simplicity of connection. And there was this amazing little story similarly, I don't know if I've told you this little one before, but it's popped into my mind now. 3 or 4 years ago, not very long ago, in the London Underground, there was a rush hour. Some man had a seizure and fell onto the tracks. And in the Underground in London, those trains come like every 3 minutes. There's not a lot of time. And so there wasn't any time. And he was seizing, so he wasn't capable of removing himself. So he was fallen. He fell between the tracks. And so this man who was standing there, one of the many people standing there, who had 2 children standing with him by this, at the time, didn't think twice, and he jumped on top of the guy, and he lay on top of him with his own weight. Because he knew the only way for him to stay down there was to be pressed by a heavy weight, and so that's why, and there was no time. So he just jumped, and he lay on him and kept them both down below the train. The train came in, and the train left, and he got up, and the guy was now okay, and got him up. And he was, the remarkable thing, of course, is afterwards he's interviewed, and he was like, well, it was the only thing to do, it's obvious. It wasn't like, oh, what can I do? It's heroic. He felt no heroism. He just was, no question. This is the love that's our true nature. Not the juicy, pink, fuzzy stuff, the sticky stuff, but the quiet stuff. The of course stuff. Reminds me yet another story. Dharma teachers are good for stories, and we collect stories from each other. This is another Dharma story. Somebody once said that there was a woman on the walking down the street, some city somewhere, and she had an embolism, and she collapsed. And in her collapse, near death, she nearly died. She left her body and had the experience of being able to be out of the body and see herself. And what she saw was that another passerby, with this woman now fallen down unconscious at his feet, bent over her and then attempted to resuscitate her and was breathing the breath of life into her. And she said, when she came, and she survived to tell the story, and she said, what made me come back into my body? And it wasn't the air. It was that he was doing it. He was giving me the kiss of life. It was his compassion in tending to me in such a personal way that just compelled me to come back. A sweet story. Just mention a couple of things that really help this inner happiness, this inner loving, this inner opening, rather than being afraid and guarded. Because as we go into daily life, 2/3 of you will be leaving, these are some of the ways when we're not able to sit in intense meditation retreat, but how to actually live and nourish and support and encourage the heart to be more open, other than what riches you will have been mining here. And if ever you read or remember to read the Paramis, the 10 perfections of being, any and all of these do support this, but I'll single out 2 or 3 of them. And just, again, remind us of their value, giving. When we don't give, when we take, the energetic experience of taking is from the world out there beyond us and shrinking it and pulling it into the small little vortex that's me. Wanting, needing, trying to get, hanging on. It's taking the big flow and fixing and fixating on it and actually reducing the spontaneity and the creativity and the possibility of movement. It's stopping, it's clinging and hanging on. Giving is the very opposite thing. It's taking the smallness that is me and expanding it and sharing it and making it be who knows what and go where and whatever may happen and whatever, it beyond me. It's relinquishing the smallness. And so it's extremely useful in opening the heart. I mean, it feels good to do, and this is why it feels good to do. When we think of it energetically, it's this movement of expansion. It's the movement of ourselves from the small point of view to the large beings which we really are. Another one is gratitude / appreciation. The loving, the beauty of things, all of that. The singing of grace. You know, the just reflecting on loveliness in wherever, whatever ways we find it. It's the taking us out of ourselves that is the value of it. Yes, it's lovely to do and to notice nice things and to enjoy them and appreciate them and honor people and thou instead of you and all of the value of the sacred. But the reason why it feels so good to be able to do that is that it's expanding this otherwise contracted state. So energetically, it's healing, bringing us into the wholeness rather than the reduced limits. Of our familiar life. And then humor. I think I'll just have to end with humor. It does the same thing. When we take ourselves seriously, we're very small. We're sort of rather big and heavy, but we're very narrow and limited. When we laugh at it and ourselves and each other and ridiculousness, it's like the big stuff of our ego is so reduced. It's such an extraordinarily brilliant thing. If it's not mean, you know, if it's done with some friendliness. I have a son, as a lot of you know, and one thing about my son is he has this great sense of humor, and it's in a very teasy, very friendly, very funny way. And so he mimics us, you know, we do something and he exaggerates it, and it's just hilarious. And it's very, very endearing. And it isn't just that it's endearing and then I like him. It's that it allows us to be comfortable with ourselves. So when we're in his company, it's comfortable. I was traveling once in Europe with him and my stepdaughter, his half-sister. And, you know, for a month, traveling in a car sometimes, you know, sharing a bed and different situations. You know, when you're on the road, you don't have your own place to run wild in. We were pretty confined some of the time. Thank God for his humor. It was like it oiled the wheels, you know, it oiled the engine of having to be rubbing up against each other, because definitely they didn't want to do the things I wanted to do some of the time, and they were irritated with me yet one more chapel in Rome, you know. It's like, oh God. And he could just turn it into such, you know, playfulness. It was lubrication. Fantastic. So I got a couple of light things to say. For example, some of you know I said this. I don't know if I said it in a talk in this retreat, but Ajahn Sumedho says this great little thing. I was telling it to a couple of you today. He has a bit of a lisp, Ajahn Sumedho. He's this 72-year-old American monk who lives in England and who's Ajahn Chah's successor. He says with his big smile and his lisp, "Samsara sucks." Roland's like that one. It's a great one. It's a great one to just be able to say every so often. It's like, oh God, samsara sucks. Nasruddin, Persian, fool, wise man. Nasruddin went to the psychiatrist complaining that he couldn't remember things. "So what's wrong?" says the psychiatrist when he arrives. He says, "Well, I can't remember things." "How long has this been going on?" "How long has what been going on?" Then, let me see, a couple of other little things. Yes, this is actually very okay. I was talking to one of you about this in one of our discussions, about how when we are a little freer, we are able to bring humor into what apparently is a somber situation. And it's okay. In fact, it's very helpful. So for instance, here's a little phrase that somebody said, it's not about the dying, this is a hospice worker, it's not about the dying, it's about the lingering. That's so trying, you know, like, Or being, you know, with somebody and it's a very intense and very loaded scenario, whatever it may be, beautiful or romantic or intimidating or something serious. And we actually, we notice some stupid little thing, you know, that the hair in their noses is, well, I'm saying that because I was thinking of this before, is moving, or I don't know if I can think of another example, but just playing in what's apparently really loaded. It's wholesome. We kind of think maybe we're being disrespectful or it's supposed to be serious, this thing, if it's loaded. But actually, we can make it really, really light and not such a big deal in all kinds of ways, sometimes the most intense situations. I had a friend called William who was dying. This is years ago, and he was dying of AIDS. And so very much knew what was going on. It took quite a while. It was quite a process. And at some point, there were maybe a dozen people. His mom had come all the way from Trinidad, and his brother, and all kinds of friends were in and out of the house. For the last few days, we knew it was imminent. And he would drift in and out of consciousness, as can happen. And somebody had brought him some flowers. And, you know, it happened all the time. And there was an empty bucket sitting over on the side. It was a plastic bucket that they'd brought these flowers in, sort of stacked away, and all crowded into this room, and it's a bit crowded, and somebody tripped. And you heard this clonking plastic bucket. And he comes into consciousness. He says, "Did somebody kick the bucket?" It just made, it's like it was so his character and so sweet and so nice to be able to be with him. And at another point, he came back up and he sort of looked around and saw all these people there. And he said, "This is called having your wake and eating it too." It's wholesome. It's like being able to be, you know, playful. Zen Judaism. Be here now, be someplace later. Someplace else later, is that so complicated? Be patient and achieve all things. Be impatient and achieve all things faster. I think that will do. Then there's the remembrance that when your face smiles, it makes your heart happier. It's not the other way around. It is the other way around, too. But actually, to put a smile on your face lightens the heart. And you may remember this little experiment that they did. The psychiatrist did this experiment where they showed funny cartoons to two groups of people to test their response, and they had them all wired up for blood pressure and heart rate and all various responses. And one group had to have, I have one with me here. Well, I have to pretend. One group were told to hold a pen in their mouth between their lips, and one group were told to hold a pen in their mouth between their teeth. And those who had the pen in their teeth, who therefore were forced to smile, laughed much more hysterically at the cartoon than those who had the pen in their lips and were unable to laugh hysterically because they had to have their mouth tight. And they didn't find it anything like so funny. So our actual countenance affects us. So, you know, if you're walking around looking all frowny and somber, you're bringing yourself down. And if you can lighten up and smooth out your face when you do at the beginning of meditation and relax whatever you can, including your face, you will actually be brightening your inner reality at the same time, as well as looking prettier, if you care. Anyway, here are some ways that we can appreciate the jewels of practice. I have a small message for you, local people. This is changing the energy significantly. But we can even, like as William was doing as he was dying, have some spaciousness around the inevitability of this. But this is a tragedy that I have to tell you about. Your friends, Natalie and Jack Lessinger, you know who they are, come to your sitting group some of the time. Have a daughter called Maya who was recently killed, was struck by a train. So this fragile life we lead, I just encourage you to know this before you go out into your day, those of you who are leaving tomorrow, and spend a little time sending some wishes of kindness for their loss.
About 90 years old.
They're old, but their daughter, whatever age.
Married 70 years.
They've been married 70 years. So they have a daughter who's no longer with us. So I'm sure whatever age you are, the loss of a child is the loss of a child. So I wanted to tell you that because Roland told me before tomorrow. So you can be holding some of that. Okay. Let's just sit quietly for a moment.